Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and I'm delighted to be joined by Seb Stafford-Blore. Hello.
Hello, Joe Devine.
JJ Ball the Bullard.
Yes, hello.
And Jonathan Rossdog McKenzie.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah? That's lovely that you're speaking so quietly. Oh, we didn't sound check. Are we fine? We're all fine. Look at that. A little look behind the curtain there at how we aren't good. Now, lots to discuss today. Morocco, of course, played France. Morocco now out of the World Cup. All a bit of a shame, really. But we'll go on to discuss their contribution to the tournament. And as France move on to the final to meet Argentina, we'll have a little look ahead to that as well. Also, we're going to play three different games today. Yes, all knowledge-based games to see who has the best knowledge here. And won't it be fun to know who has the best knowledge? Do you think it's you, JJ?
Well, as we know, to catch them is the real test. Yes. So we'll find that. To answer the questions is not my cause.
No. And what about you, John?
I don't have any aspirations as to my performance in the quiz.
Well, if you feel like that at home, that you don't have any aspirations as to your performance in your daily life, let's say, then perhaps you'll find some inspirational material on The Athletic. Visit theathletic.com/TIFO, theathletic.com/TIFO, where if you want to learn more about football, you sure as hell are going to do that, whether you like it or not, on theathletic.com/TIFO. But for now, I will leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of, I guess, Hugo Lloris, who appears later in the podcast as we discuss him, not in real life. That would be fun. Morocco 0 to France. Where else to start, Seb? But with why you said France were doing a bit of a Real Madrid thing towards the end of this game. What did you mean by that?
Yes, there's a half-baked theory, Joe, in the sense that Real Madrid are kind of, ever since they sort of they came off their succession of European Cup winners, feels like they are perpetually underrated in European football. And yet they manage to be whatever they need to be in knockout games in the latter stage of the Champions League. So this season, obviously, against Paris Saint-Germain and Manchester City and Liverpool, last season even, you never really discuss them in tactical terms. You don't talk about what they are shape-wise and don't really always talk about them in kind of one-on-one matchups. You just, they're able within these sort of short 10 to 15 minute periods to win games, to dominate little periods and invoke a little bit of chaos. And France aren't exactly like that. It's just that they're not really a protagonist in the sense that all the way through this World Cup, probably against England, definitely again tonight against Morocco, they weren't the dominant side. They weren't overpowering their opposition. They just dominated in the crucial moments. Mm. And dominated is probably the wrong word. They were effective and efficient.
I think it's interesting because they played England. And obviously living in England and having this conversation in England, it's impossible to avoid the narrative around the England
team. Where
are
you going with this?
What I'm talking
about... We're going to talk about England.
No, not at all. What I'm going to say is that, there's been a lot of discussion about Gareth Southgate and, I think for want of a better term, negative tactics.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
But it's best remembered, as we said on the show after the England-France game a few days ago, that's something that I think has been partly inspired by some of the work that the French team have done. So I think you get to the latter stages of a World Cup and you see France kind of, effectively or efficiently making their way towards a final, and you do sort of feel a little bit underwhelmed is maybe too strong of a term for it, but you kind of want to see them blow away a team, don't you?
You do, because the kind of collective power of their talent makes you want to give their football a kind of aspirational quality. You want to see what they look like in top gear. At the same time, though, progressing through the latter stages of a World Cup is, in modern day, because of the volume of football that all players have to experience and go through, it's about surviving. And it's about dealing with different threats and different opposition, different challenges, and getting through round by round. And probably no one typifies that better than Deschamps France, because if you look back at their World Cup history between this tournament and last, it never really sets the world alight. That kind of potential of all that talent combined is only ever teased. It's never truly realized. And yet what you're left with is these little little moments, like a flash from an Mbappe or an inspirational moment from an Olivier Giroud. Or I suppose the closest we've got to the kind of sustained performance this tournament from you know, French players, probably Antoine Griezmann. Yeah. I think we're going to talk about it a little bit later in more depth.
Well, tell you what, let's do it now.
Okay.
Why not?
Okay.
Nice segue. Because JJ, you wanted to talk about Antoine Griezmann and his role within the team. Now's your opportunity.
Yes. Well, Griezmann, you think of as being a really creative forward who has been really important for teams like Atletico Madrid in the past. He was at Barcelona for a while, but I think even he's forgotten that.
Yeah, I think of him as only being able to play for 30 minutes due to...
Well, because of that transfer thing, yeah. So for this team, he does... He's a forward. He helps with the first line of engagement, showing where the ball goes. But France are quite passive in the first line. Let the ball come past them. They drop deep a little bit because they want to be able to exploit the space that people will leave when they push up. But as you saw today, he was everywhere all the time, just like nipping in and out of spaces to be able to both win the ball back as part of a midfield three, but then also help link things in the last part of the pitch. Because what you have is Mbappe comes in from the left, wide left, into more of a half space in the middle. And then when they get into the final third, he's more through the middle, like an actual central striker. And Dembele pulls off more to the right as a winger. So there's a bit of space between Giroud, the striker, and Dembele, the right winger. So he often floats into that little bit, but he just goes everywhere where the ball is. Often when Morocco were pushing forward, he was the one that was back and the ball would drop exactly where he is. I think it's a clever reading of the game combined with excellent technical qualities.
Yeah.
It's one of the things like Didier Deschamps was never the best player. Like, he was really important to how France played. When he played, he was like a water carrier.
Yeah.
That was his best thing. And there's a book called The Captain Class, and they talk about Didier Deschamps and how important he was to that team in 98 when they won the World Cup. Like, never the best player, surrounded really good players, but made all the rest of them around him better. And Griezmann is kind of doing that water carrier role for France in this tournament, but as a really technically clever player as well out of the pitch. So it just makes him even better than he has been.
It's quite interesting, though, isn't it?
I was just going to ask, actually, because do you think it changes the way that you approach the game mentally? Because if you're playing an attacking role, you can kind of drift in and out of the game and you can kind of pick your moments. If you play in the role that Griezmann's occupied during this World Cup, you can never let your concentration waver. Like, there was a moment in the second half where he was the first to a dropping ball in his own penalty box, 12 yards out. And if he doesn't make that interception, there's a chance for a shot on goal. Like, it's 90 minutes worth of concentration. It'd be interesting to know what it's like to kind of condition yourself to move between, like, the club version of Antoine Griezmann and the one that we've seen here. It's very different.
I think good players just adapt to it.
I guess so,
like, you see Mbappe, like, he wants to be the very best, like no one ever was, right? And so he's trying to do all different things that he was doing in the past. So he's now playing like more of a all-round forward as opposed to just a goal scorer. In the past...
He was a bit chancy in today's game, though.
How do you mean chancy?
It's a Pokemon, I don't know. I'm just trying to throw a little pun in there.
No. What do you mean?
Nothing. No, I don't mean anything.
I don't know about it. Yeah. So Mbappe's trying to do far more than he has done in the past.
Yeah. I thought he was a real Geo dude in today's game.
No. Like, Mbappe knows the power that's inside. Whereas Griezmann is trying to adapt to the team that he's in. And I think, like, where Griezmann in the past has been a star and been like the focal point of an Atletico Madrid team, he is very much filling in the gaps for other players in this one. I think it just makes it's better for the team. So you're more likely to win and more likely to look like a better player.
Yeah.
If you're doing those things.
Well, I was going to say, you know, we've talked about Antoine Griezmann a little bit already. Further to your point before, Seb, and I address this to you now, John, it's easy for us to identify Antoine Griezmann had fabulous performances for this France team. Hugo Lloris is a player who's had a couple of really, really good performances for this team. Mbappe has scored 5 goals. Olivier Giroud, I mean, is now France's all-time top goal scorer. And I think, you know, that with discussion around if Benzema had been available for selection, that Giroud may not have even played. It's kind of easy to see, despite them never really blowing anybody away, why they are where they are. Because, like, their key players have really shone in the moments that this mattered.
I think there's two things I'd say about this. First one is that, like, I think Griezmann's most important role has been out of possession, because we've talked a lot about Mbappe not wanting to involve himself so much in the out of possession side of things. So France playing a 4-2-3-1, usually in these sorts of situations, if you're going to press into if you're going to move into a 4-4-2 mid block, which, you know, France do, you would have your two wide players dropping in. So you'd have Mbappe dropping in closer to Theo Hernandez, Dembele dropping closer to Koundé, and then you'd have Griezmann, the 10, pushing up alongside the striker, and then you've got your 4-4-2. Obviously, Deschamps recognises that Mbappe isn't going to be willing to do that kind of backtracking. And so what actually happens is that Mbappe comes up alongside Giroud and so forms the second part of that forward press. And it's Griezmann who drops in alongside the rest of the midfield. And they form the 4-4-2 that way. And I think that is the big difference between France this time around versus last time around, is that they now have this structure which actually mitigates some of the stuff that that Mbappe is doing. But you couldn't do that without a player like Griezmann. And there's very, I think, you know, there's a very limited market for players who are both creative but also physically adept enough to be able to play that kind of role as well. Yeah. So I think that that's like a lot of what France do well is based around that defensive structure.
I was going to say that the physical part is really important, I think, because Mbappe, like, obviously he's brilliant with the ball. Technically, he's one of the best players in the world, right? He's incredible. But like, is some of the physical things he can do, like run faster than any creature in the world. Like you saw at the end, he just absolutely bodied people by just racing away from them. And it's important maybe to not say that it's Mbappe not wanting to do defensive work. It might be that he's learned to or has been encouraged to not do as much disciplined defending in certain situations because he helps the team defend in another way by being in a more dangerous position, ready to pounce rather than coming back. It might be that
it seems to be something which links a lot of the best players in the world, that they don't really do anything off the ball. And I wonder, you know, if that is because coaches think, look, let's emphasize all of the
when
best
you maximize
things
their performance, their effect with the ball. I feel like it's like, if you're over a certain age, you're conditioned to think about this in terms of, like, you know, the old school number 10, the playmaker who did nothing, just strolled around the pitch. Whereas I think now it's a tactic by design, because you don't want to tie up your game winning forward, wide forward, inside forward, whatever the case, in like working his own, you know, defensive zone.
That's a bit like you and your job here at TIFO, isn't it? We don't want to tie you up with, you know, having to live in the correct country
or spell things correctly,
or even really do most of your job.
Do all the flavors.
We want to emphasize you on the podcast, you know, lending your knowledge once a day.
And say something really, really funny and then leave.
Yeah, you're doing, you know what? You're doing a fantastic job, and I'm glad that there are other people here pulling
the
weight.
I am the kind of the Mbappe, everybody else is the water carrier.
That's right, yeah everyone.
Yes.
I don't mind that.
Yeah.
Works for me. Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, let's carry on talking about Mbappe now, because you wanted, Seb, to talk about Mbappe for France versus a sort of PSG Mbappe. You know, we have this sometimes with players that perform slightly differently, not necessarily better or worse, but in a different capacity for club and country. What are your thoughts as that relates to Mbappe specifically?
Well, over the last sort of two World Cups for France, I think what we've seen is Mbappe inject himself into the play at critical moments and to tremendous effect. Obviously, tonight he's crucial for the second goal, scored a brilliant goal in the last final, has been actually pretty good, but not in a sort of an overwhelming way for France. Like, he was pretty quiet against England. The first goal he scored against Poland was, I think, will end up being one of the goals of the tournament. And yet it came in a match where he wasn't necessarily the most prominent French player. Whereas for PSG, particularly before Gauthier got there this season, what you'd see sometimes is he was almost used as a means of transferring PSG up the pitch. So you'd see him get the ball 25 yards from his own goal and not quite run in a straight line, but basically just carry it as quickly and as vertically as possible in a way that kind of destroyed the opposition. And it was this idea that in Ligue 1, he could be a sort of almost a playground bully type of player.
Great American footballer.
Well, yeah, like he had a kind of not quite running back quality, but he would be. It seemed to be the extent of their game plan. Whereas the Mbappe who plays for France is a more sparingly used player, potentially more explosive. It's a little bit to do with obviously the standard of Ligue 1 and the kind of the level of challenge that PSG face on a week-to-week basis. But there is a difference, and it's kind of interesting to see all these different versions. There's no sort of definitive what's better. It's just it's interesting to see that adaption. I mean, it's not quite as dramatic as the one that Griezmann's gone through, obviously. But it is interesting to note that there is a variation to his game, and there is an ability to play more than a single role, whilst we're sort of having a go at him not doing any defending, because that's, you know, that felt a bit mean-spirited.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Well, listen, also, you guys were talking before about why you think the World Cup is a bit broken. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's because France keep winning it now. They won it last time. You shouldn't be able to win it two times in a row. It should only be a new team every time.
That's what you believe.
Yeah. It's a bit like how at school everyone supported Man United because they always used to win stuff.
Right.
And now France are basically to have all the best players. And they just
have you noticed that all the people at your school have started to support France? Is
they
that
do,
what you're
yeah.
saying?
Yeah, they all started speaking French because I am still at school.
Right, yeah. But it's good that you're still there, though.
But there's something about it, like genuinely, it's not... It would be great for people in France because they all support France.
Mm.
So I'm sure they'd be very, very happy and they can enjoy it more because they know more what it's like to have won the World Cup already. So then they can expect, like, you know, celebrate it properly this time if they were to win it.
Mm.
Still got to get past Leo Messi, by the way.
Yeah.
But you kind of want to be a bit of separation between World Cups. 1998 felt like it was a couple of years ago even, and they won that.
Yeah, when in fact it was many years ago.
It was longer. When they were in the final.
24
well.
Years mm-hmm. ago.
Yeah.
At the same time, do you not think that that some of the stories, some of the purely footballing stories from within the World Cup have actually been really good for the game? And so it's like Morocco being in a World Cup semi-final and playing really, really well. Mm-hmm. Like that was not a comfortable 2-0. Like I think for long periods of the game, Morocco were the better side, the more dangerous side. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Saudi Arabia in the group against Argentina saw some of the things that Australia did earlier
Japan
on the tournament.
And South Korea getting
Japan,
really fun.
South Korea, like Croatia knocking out Brazil.
Well, I should say Japan getting as far as they usually do.
But in different circumstances. I mean, mm-hmm. you wouldn't usually expect them to knock Germany, well, not knock Germany out, but beat them in the first game and set them on a course for elimination.
Yeah.
And it feels like with club football being the way that it is and kind of some of the financial disparities and the game as a whole in Europe becoming a bit more predictable
mm-hmm.
And increasingly so over the years, it's nice to see this. It's nice to see trends being broken and Morocco becoming the first African side to reach the semifinals, for instance. And these things sure. which aren't just... JJ's kind of right about the way that France progressed the tournament. Completely agree with that. It's just that alongside that, you do still have a little moments which enliven your interest in the game or awaken them. Reawaken them, perhaps.
There was a nice little paragraph in Jacob Whitehead's piece on The Athletic about Morocco that I read today, where he said, obviously, as you just mentioned, Morocco, the first African team in a semi-final. They're the second Muslim-majority nation in a semi-final after Turkey in mm-hmm. 2002. And also, they're the first Arab team in the semi-finals as well. And it concluded by saying that, you know, the identity of Morocco now hotly contested, but for fun reasons, which is quite nice. John, from a footballing perspective, you know, specifically footballing perspective, how would you rate the tournament so far? I mean, there's been quite a fair amount of upsets, haven't there? And obviously, that's a subjective question, but what does your subjectivity bring to it?
You always say that I focus on like the out of possession stuff. And so in many respects, I've quite enjoyed the tournament because there's been a few things that have been happening out of possession. Namely, I think, and most importantly, that the smaller sides are much better. Out of possession, and that's led to, I think, a little bit more competitiveness across the board. Whether or not that makes for a better tournament in general, I guess most people would argue with, because I think a lot of people don't really care about the out of possession stuff. They want to see goals and they want to see like exciting attacking players as well. But I think in general the tournament has been high on drama, maybe more than it has been on particularly tactical things, but that's just the nature of international football, right? There's only so much you can do in possession without a huge amount of time on your hands to prep.
I keep thinking Spain-Germany was the best game in the group stages. It was the only one that... Maybe best game is the wrong way of phrasing that, but it was the highest quality game.
Yeah, like the most like elite football. But that shouldn't be that surprising, I guess, because all of those players are playing sort of fairly standard elite football.
Yeah.
Week in, week out. And so,
Do you think that France, Argentina will be like that?
I don't think so, no, because I think that France play a fairly small C conservative, they adopt that sort of small C conservative approach. I think Argentina, I think people may be surprised by Argentina in this game. I rewatched the game against Croatia this morning and I was really impressed with how they approached that game. They did certain things that caused Croatia a lot of problems, and not many teams have done that really this tournament, right? We've gone through the whole tournament with people being like, well, you know, that thing happens when, I mean, I questioned whether or not Croatia had been a little bit lucky with their run. But there's a weird phenomenon when like teams get lucky a lot of times to a point where people say, well, they can't be lucky. There must be something behind it, rather than what you could also argue, which is just they've been really lucky.
Yeah.
I don't want to pontificate about that, but you could, I think you can argue the same sort of thing for France. They have like a fairly conservative approach and it's worked so far. They haven't given up huge amounts of chances and they've generated enough chances to win. But I also think that Argentina are playing much more proactive way of playing. They've got Messi. They know that he's a strength and they'll try and get him into the game the best way possible. And I think that the way that they did that against Croatia actually might suit them quite nicely for the France game as well. So I do think that it will be an interesting game, but neither of those two teams are trying to do what elite sides are trying to do, which is control the game in every phase of possession, have caveats in place for if you lose the ball high up the field, to be able to defend counterattacks. Like France are not pushing their fullbacks down the field that much. Argentina are a little bit more, but Argentina also aren't sort of doing that positional thing where you spread everyone out across the field and try and get, you know, exploit space between all of the other fullbacks. They're a lot more centrally focused, I think, as well. So I don't think it will be like watching a Champions League game, but I do think it will be a good game all the same.
Okay. Well, we'll come back and discuss that game a little bit more. Let's have a break now, though. And when we come back, we'll play a game. Ah, yes. What a lovely break that was. Now it's time to play a delightful game, everyone. Now, this game is the World Cup World Cup goal scorers game. The World Cup top goal scorers game. Yeah? Excited about that? Ready for that?
I've just changed what's on my screen so I can't see the scorers. Yeah.
Now, listen, the game here is as follows. Nobody look at their chat because people in the chat will tell you what the answers are.
I'll change my window. Okay.
We want to guess players that have scored 10 or more goals in all World Cups. Yes?
Okay.
Go.
Miroslav Klose.
Yes, Miroslav Klose with 16 goals scored. He's currently the top.
Messi.
Messi has scored 11 goals. Yes, that's correct.
Jürgen Klinsmann.
Jürgen Klinsmann has also scored 11 goals. Who else we got?
Mbappe must be in there after this tournament.
Mbappe may well be in there, but he's not in the Wikipedia page, which may not have been updated yet. Although it would have been, because he didn't score today, did he?
He didn't.
No, so he's not in there yet, no.
Batistuta.
Oh, Mbappe's on 9 goals. Yeah. Gabriel Batistuta has 10 goals for Argentina.
Jean-Pierre Papin.
No.
Paolo Rossi.
This game is...
Gerd Müller must be in there because he scored loads of goals.
Pele.
Pele's 100% in there. Pele scored 12 goals. Maradona is not in here. Gerd Müller is in there, though. Gerd Müller for West Germany scored 14 goals. And I'll tell you the rest. You've all played very well. Good game. Well played.
Original Ronaldo.
Original Ronaldo is in second place, of course, with 15 goals for Brazil. We have Just Fontaine for France, who scored, I think, has the record for the most
goals in a single tournament.
He had the record 13, as well until Klose overtook him or something, was that right?
Maybe. I'm not sure. I think it was an awful lot. I don't know if that one's been overtaken yet, has it?
Klose's the...
Oh, you mean the overall?
Yeah.
That's closer now, I think.
Original Ronaldo has more.
Than 16?
No, he's got 15. Fontaine has 13. Yeah, okay. Pele with 12. We have Sandor Kocsis. I can't say the name. The Hungarian player. I have learnt that name once before to say it in a video.
I think your pronunciation was okay.
Kocsis?
I think so.
Not sure. Who else do we have here? We have Helmut Rahn from West Germany. Gary Lineker with 10 goals for England. We said Batistuta. Kubeas for Peru. Thomas Müller for Germany has 10. There we go. And... Lato for Poland.
If you go to the German Football Museum in Dortmund, you can see the ball that Helmut Rahn scored his very, very famous goal with Miracle of Bern. Yeah.
Yeah, lovely name.
In there.
Helmut Rahn. Okay, fine. Now, listen, let's talk a little bit about Morocco, who were, you know, one of the favourites here at TIFO, let's be honest, for the last few games there. The hope that they would go all the way was there with us. As we watched, they didn't. But anyway, I want to talk about their out-of-possession play, John. And naturally, I'm going to come to you to do that. But first, let me tell you that in this book which is hiding my drink, this book that you see here in front of you or are listening to, How to Watch Football, 52 Rules for Understanding the Beautiful Game on and Off the Pitch. Now, chapter one of this book, John McKenzie, I know you've read it. Back to front, cover to cover. Chapter one is of course, don't watch the ball. And what does that mean to people?
Well, I think that when you're watching as a fan, you tend to focus on the ball because that's where the action is, right? And when I'm usually watching a game as a fan, I'm watching around the ball and focusing on that. But
yes, redefine your understanding of what and where the action is. Now, you were saying before that you thought that people don't enjoy off the ball stuff, but we do. And once you've read this chapter and listened to John speak, you will. Now, listen, this book is available online and is also available in your local Waterstones or indeed your local international bookstore, wherever you live. Not wherever, but in many places. You know, if you can't find
your local online retailer.
Many apologies. But it is available in many areas. So if you're looking for a last-minute Christmas gift for someone who needs to learn how to watch football, you know, or just you think they will enjoy it and you're friends with them, do consider. But John, go on to explain to me why chapter one of this book is so important. And let's link it to Morocco's performance so that we can really plug the product.
Well, I thought that... I thought that Morocco are an interesting side because they did play in a low block, but I think when a lot of people say low block, they just sort of think it's a sort of one size fits all thing, and that you know you don't have a concept of a good low block or a bad low block. But actually, I thought that Morocco's approach was just really top notch all the way through the tournament. Mm. They defended deep well, they expanded really well, they moved between those two situations quite
nicely. What do you mean by expanded?
Yeah, so they transitioned. So they had a bunch of really exciting wide players who they could use when they won the ball back in certain situations to then try and hit the opposition when the opposition left space for them to exploit. So obviously they had Ziyech on one side and then Boufal on the other. And then they had Nasiri, a sort of classic number nine as well. So the idea is that you sit deep, pick the ball up when you do, but then try and use a quick transition, so really direct attacking to get the ball into dangerous areas to score. But most of the tournament, they've been actually playing with a back four rather than a back five, which is how they came out tonight. So usually they had Amala in here alongside Unahi and let's just get rid of one of these
in central midfield.
Yeah, so we've got Amrabat as the pivot player here, two eights and then a front three in front of them, and the general idea was that they're going to sit in a low block and they were going to protect the wide areas in particular. So the back four were quite narrow, and the two wide players did a huge amount of defensive work. So we talked about how Mbappe doesn't do that, but both Ziyech and Boufal were happy to drop in alongside the midfield to help out. Now, usually when you're coming up against a back four, when the ball comes out to, let's say, a fullback, it will be the wide players who push up. But the problem when you do that is that you actually allow a lot of space in this kind of area that can be then exploited by opposition players.
And that area is between the winger and their fullback.
Yeah, the area between the winger and the fullback. And the problem with that is that you can then allow dangerous attacking players to get isolated 1v1 against fullbacks. And when you've got players like Mbappe and Dembele, that's not a good thing.
No.
So what actually we've seen from Morocco is that rather than pushing their wide players out in the press, they push their number eights out instead. And so we've got Amala on one side, Unahi on the other, and they'll be the ones who press up onto the fullback. And what that means is that you're allowing there to be coverage in the fullback area, that double coverage of players. Now, that was all well and good until they played a back three today. So they had Amala not on, Dari in instead. Now what's happened is that if you're going to press out with your number eight onto the fullback, you're leaving a huge amount of space in the central area here now.
You're wide open.
Yeah, and for the first goal, what we saw was Griezmann get the ball to feet. The centre-back, feeling the need to be quite aggressive, pushing forward onto him rolling, getting around him, and then carrying the ball into the box. And then the ball obviously broke down a little bit there, but that was the situation that led to the first goal. And after that point, Morocco switched up then around the 20-minute mark, I think, where they then went back to playing the 4-1-4-1 that they were playing before, and it just gave them a lot more defensive stability. So
why do you think they would have made the change? If they were capable of playing a four and it wasn't due to injuries or you know, absentee players, then what was the issue?
I mean, I would throw this over to JJ, but like my gut is that they wanted to get Saïss in into the team, as well as I think... Agüero, the West Ham centre-back, was also possibly available. So they probably prepped, thinking they could get most of their back players in, their best back players in. Agüero pulls out in the warm-up. And I think they probably, at that point, they probably thought we could go 4-1-4-1 here, but we've prepped all week with a back five, so let's just see how it goes. They've conceded the goal, and then very soon after that, I mean, Saez is obviously carrying an injury anyway, and they flipped it around. But I'm not entirely sure why they made that. To me, it doesn't make sense, because what was so great about them was that they were able to press out with their eights, with Amrabat doing really good positional defensive work in the space behind. Mm. And that was what made them so dangerous, because they were sitting in a low block, but they were really aggressive in that low block. And I think they were relying on their centre-backs to step forward. But when you do that against a team like France, and they've got players like Griezmann and Mbappe and even Giroud to an extent, they're always going to be able to play those small advantages.
What do you think about that, JJ?
Thanks, John. So I think what we've got here is that they probably made the change because Amala, who's been playing in midfield alongside Unahi and Amrabat, I think he was probably carrying an injury or was really tired.
Yeah.
Because they subbed him off late in the game as well. So it kind of points towards that being the reason. That said, when you look at the team and how France are going to line up, there are tactical reasons why they would have done what they've done and switched to the back three. I think John's dead on with the centre-backs following players out, because you know Giroud's going to be a handful in the middle. So if you have three defenders surrounding him, that's going to be very useful. 3v1 is good. But Mbappe basically makes that 3v2. So then what you've got is coverage. So you've got Saez or Dari, I can't remember who's on the right side, next to Mbappe, but also coverage from Hakimi. You can tuck in if you need. And then you get Ziyech coming back to double up in wide areas when Theo Hernandez overlaps, which he always does. So you know that Theo Hernandez will be on the far left, Mbappe will be in the central spaces. Then you can squish him in, surround them with defenders, and then Griezmann will come along as well. So basically you then get like 1v1v1 across the back line of three central Moroccan defenders against three France forwards. Then Dembele on the right is more wide. He plays a bit closer to the touchline. So then you've got your left wing back can double up with Boufal to take care of him. So that, in theory, should lock them down and force them to try and push up a little bit. And if they pushed up, then you're going to leave a bit of a space further up the pitch. So you could, if you're lucky, break behind Dembele with Boufal, break behind Konate with Ziyech, and Nesri can maybe get in as well. And I think that might have been part of the thinking.
Mm.
But a lot of these things, like a lot of tactics, people say managers are geniuses or they're idiots for doing what they're doing. But it's to do with players are ill or they're injured or they're just not on it on the day. Like you can see they're crumbling under pressure or something like that. I'm sure this stuff happens. And to me, it looked like Amala, who I'd imagine would have started because he was so important for them all the way through the tournament. He was one of the eights that helped the press. He was the one that was mostly going to join the forward and part of the press from the midfield. And it's just too many injuries. And think if like Morocco were missing there, all their best players, and that was the big thing. Like we were talking earlier about France basically being Real Madrid or United in the 90s or something. They just have so many good players, whereas Morocco need those ones that they rely on, and that's probably why.
That was good analysis on both counts, wasn't it, Seb?
Really nice. Really
nice. I really enjoyed that. And do you know what? If you listening or watching at home think, I want to sound like that, how to watch football, yeah? Yeah? 52 chapters to help you sound like JJ Bull and John McKenzie. We should have written that as the subtitle.
Also, you know, subscribe to The Athletic. That will help as well.
No. Come now.
Well,
get the
that.
Book first.
Book first. Book Athletic first. Second, but do both.
Definitely, you know. Get the book. Let's have one more game before a break. It's time for another game. The last game didn't work that well, but let's do another one because, you know, it's written down here. Now, this game is all based around the idea that Hugo Lloris said has 144 caps for France.
Yes.
Which is I thought you were going to say, is the most in the history of the France team.
It is. He broke the record against England, actually. He beat Lilian Thuram's record in that game.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So I thought we could do a two-part game here.
Ooh, interesting.
The first of those is to try to guess some names from the list of players who have the most international caps ever. Now, listen, many of them are rather obscure.
Okay.
So don't worry about getting them all.
Right.
But would you like to try to guess someone?
I will start with Rafael Marquez.
Yes, this game's hard. Rafael.
Marquez.
Well, how do you Marquez with a Q?
With a Q and a Z.
Oh, Rafael Marquez. Yes, he has 148 caps for Mexico, but I can tell you he's only joint 41st on the list.
I would say
not
Iker Casillas will be on there somewhere.
Who?
Iker Casillas.
Yes.
He'll be there.
No.
No?
Yes. He's joint 18th with 167. Very impressive. Yeah. Who else do you want to guess?
I will have a go at, I think Sergio Ramos will be on there.
Sergio Ramos is 8th with 180. Yeah. 180 caps. International caps, all teams.
He did not play in 180 World Cups.
Buffon, let's have a look and see if Buffon is on the list. Buffon is on the list. He's joint 11th with 176. So Sergio Ramos currently the highest player. Now, before you keep going, unless you were going to add something interesting, or are you going to pick another name?
Another name.
No. Now let's give John a little go here. The one to beat at the moment is Sergio Ramos in 8th place with 180. Now there's definitely at least one person on this list that you could name.
Well, I'm thinking that Cristiano Ronaldo recently got the record for goals. So, and he beat Ali Daei. So Ali Daei must have played a lot of games. So I'm going to go with Ali Daei.
Oh, I thought you were going to go with Cristiano Ronaldo. Well, and if Ronaldo, you had done, Ronaldo, you would have won the game. Because Ronaldo is joint first with 196.
Is Ali Daei on there?
That is ridiculous.
Let me see if Ali Daei is on here. Yes, but in joint 41st with 148.
So he's pretty prolific then if he was...
It is pretty prolific, yeah. I have to admit, I don't know many of these players, but in joint first with Cristiano Ronaldo is Al Mutawa from Kuwait, who also has 196, and Sochin An from Malaysia, who has 195 for some reason, but it seems to be joint first. I'm not sure I understand why. But also, quite incredibly... did that in a career that was only spanning 14 years, as opposed to the other two joint first, who were 18 and 19 years respectively. So that is an enormous number of caps. Also, names that we might recognize, Maynor Figueroa from Honduras, 175.
Ah, Wigan. Maynor Figueroa.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. We also have on this list names of Hossam Hassan, of course, for Egypt with 170.
Is Sebastian Larsson on that list?
I haven't seen Larsson on this list.
He will be playing for Sweden.
Sunil Chetri is getting a lot of love in the chat.
Diego Godin with 161 for Uruguay. Luka Modric, 161 also. Nice to see that there are some. Yes. Landon Donovan, the United States of America, 155. Mm. And Alexis Sanchez, 152 for Chile, as well as Gary Medel, who also has 152. Mm-hmm. There you go.
We're going to say a different country then. All for Chile as well same. As.
Also for Chile.
It's the Vatican City.
Yeah. Very exciting. I wonder who the first... indeed. Now, good that I wondered that, isn't it? Because the next version of this game is the England team. Mm. And I'm sorry for JJ, of course, being a Scottish supporter, and you too, John, but you both live here, and I wonder if you follow the team. Would you be able to guess for me some of the top performers there for
Bobby
international
Charlton.
Caps? Bobby Charlton is actually fairly... Well, he's 7th on the list.
Peter Shilton
is top with 125 caps.
So
the most capped player ever. 0 goals, though.
Beckham.
Rubbish.
Gerrard, Lampard, Beckham. I think they're all centurions.
Well, Gerrard, Lampard and Beckham. Yes, a 3rd, 4th and 8th, respectively.
Adams?
Don't see.
Shea Adams.
He's doing the Scottish
Tyler
team.
Adams, actually.
I will tell you that the 2nd place, of course, with 53 goals... As
Ashley
well
Cole?
As 120 caps is Rooney. Ashley Cole is on the list here as well, yeah. And other than that, we have Billy Wright with 105. And that's it. That's all the ones over 100.
If you get off the train in Wolverhampton, there's a pub that you come to called the Billy Wright. It's named after him. Very, very famous ex-Wolves player.
Right.
Former England captain as well.
Well, there we go. Yeah. There we go. And, you know.
Don't know why.
Terry Butcher on 77. Right. Now, fine. That was our games. Fun, wasn't it? Enjoy that?
It was fine.
It's really fun.
Yeah, that's good.
It was fine.
Yeah. Yeah,
getting some low energy from you.
I do feel quite tired.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What can we do to pep you up?
I don't know. We were talking about this earlier. We were trying to...
I think it's not showing him Adam Curtis films is the way to do it.
No. That wasn't... How dare you disgrace the name?
Hey, I know...
You're not even worthy to say the name.
I'm not
Curtis.
Saying they're not good. I'm saying for
That
Sebs.
Wasn't the thing that made you tired, was it?
No.
What made you tired when you arrived here and then?
I arrived here and then I had a little bit of a downturn and I've been...
You had that pasta?
I had that pasta. It was very nice, but I did have the pasta.
Bit filling,
and
hey?
I had that baked potato yesterday and I felt a bit jaded.
Yeah. Well, now remember...
Nearly at the end of
Jaded
the World
Sancho,
Cup.
Someone else with some England caps.
Now remember that maybe the TIFO audience is different. Who could know? But most audiences like a little pep. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They don't enjoy to watch people in privileged positions complain. So what do you think about giving... What do you think about adding a little zing to that, Pep? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, all right. Okay, yeah? I can handle that.
Give me a Rooney.
No. Let me have some Goblin from JJ.
A little Goblin?
Hello, sir. You
took... But do the arms.
And from you, the Goblin.
No, it's named after you.
No, listen, don't make John besmirch the Goblin. Okay. Come now, they're his people.
Okay,
fine. Now, listen, we're going to have a break. And when we come back, that may well have been the break. We don't know. But when we come back from the break, we're going to do a quick conversation about... again, looking forward to the final. A little bit about scouting, and then we'll be done.
Rooney!
Okay, well, there we go. We already heard from John McKenzie on looking ahead to the final there, France-Argentina. But a newly energised Seb Stafford-Blaw would love to lend his opinion to the chorus.
I really like France.
Yeah?
I really like France. I think they're just going to be too strong. Just because I, like, really, last night was the first time I'd actually been impressed by Argentina.
Yeah, okay.
And
they were very impressive yesterday, though.
Yeah, and also, I think it's not to denigrate the performances of players like Julian Alvarez, who's been fantastic, and I thought Otamendi was very, very good last night, too. But France don't have the same reliance on individual players. Like, it's not... If England kind of fan this out to their cost, if Mbappe doesn't perform, they can still hurt you. You can lock a player down in that French side, and somebody else will emerge. And I kind of think that's been the story, because they came into the tournament, everybody's talking about how you cope with Mbappe, how you deal with Benzema before he got injured, and then all of these other sort of secondary performance, like members of their chorus emerged. Rabiot was great. Tchouameni was had a little bit of an iffy game tonight, but was a difference maker against England, scored a brilliant goal. Griezmann we've covered, but rightly so, because he's been fantastic. So the threats are more diverse. It's more of a... Playing France is a huge conundrum for anybody. And I don't know, there have been moments throughout the tournament, I hope I'm not being harsh, but there have been moments in the tournament when that Argentinian defence has looked ropey. And also, like, emotionally so. I remember when they conceded the third goal of the game against Argentina, that's not right, is it? When they conceded the third goal of the game against themselves?
Yeah.
That's probably not right.
I think that's wrong.
I think I meant Australia.
That would be bad, though, if they did that.
If they did that, their defence would be rubbish if they were conceding goals to themselves.
Yeah.
You saw a little bit of fragility there. And I don't know, the same against the Dutch. They were completely in control of that game. And the Dutch did little more than just throw on two massive blokes at the top of the formation. Yeah. And it rattled them. And I just think France will be a bit too good.
Okay.
So, yes.
Okay, interesting.
I'm putting my cue back in the rack. Somebody else talk.
There it is. Well, listen, I was going to say, we'll come back to hear what you think about the final after we've had this conversation about scouting, because we'll roll it in to points about JJ Bull. But let's stay with you for the beginning of this conversation about scouting. Now, why shouldn't one use the World Cup for scouting there, JJ Bull? Because, of course, you know, Morocco seemed like a sort of prime example of a group of players who, you know, maybe yesteryear would have earned big moves after a tournament like this.
Well, because sometimes players just perform better on this certain stage because it's their time to shine. Suddenly they get to be the best player within a worse group. So if you take, like, Ziyech, for example, is an amazing for Morocco in this tournament. But you put him into a team with other players who are just as good technically as he is, and he suddenly doesn't stand out as much because everyone's at the same level. Like, there are players who you'll have no idea how good they are technically in the Premier League because they don't show that off or use that, because the only technique they need is first touch movement, like pass and move. And you often see like really good players shine in leagues like La Liga or the Eredivisie. There's a little bit more time on the ball. They tend to be maybe in a team that has more possession, and you're not getting quite so aggressive players coming at you. So you can shine out a little bit more. In the Champions League, a bit different. The pace is a bit slower, so maybe those players do then stand out a bit more. I don't know what I'm saying there. But I think another thing with it is that sometimes players stand out in teams because the team spirit is such that everyone just adds a little bit to it. And you can't take that from a different team, put it into yours.
I heard this one about communication as well. Obviously, you know, like usually all the players speak the same language and often speak the same language as the coach. And so communication is a lot more straightforward.
Maybe to an extent, but when you're on a football pitch, I mean, at the depth of language, I don't think needs to be particularly difficult. You're mostly
people
pointing
speak with their feet.
I wonder where the culture's won. Like when you're away with your international team at a World Cup, like generally, I mean, you know, some teams are, you know, more diverse and have a broader culture than others. But Like, generally, there are more common reference points. I think it's easier for certain players. Also, if you watch a player at World Cup, you're watching them for, at most, about a month and probably, at best, seven games. You're not seeing, like, how they cope with an eight-month season. You're not seeing, like, how they deal with life outside of the bubble of a squad. So during the World Cup, they all live together. They all generally have these sort of campuses and resorts that they train in. You know, during the regular season, you've got players living by themselves. They're living in, generally speaking, bigger cities.
What's the motivation as well? Like, you know what it is in the World Cup, because it's to try and win
the highlight of your career. Like, it's kind of, it's legacy affirming, and it's kind of the high point of a player's 12 to 14 year career, in a way that, like, club football just isn't.
And conversely, though, like, if a player you've been scouting for a long time does suddenly, we talked about this before, if a player does then stand out a little bit, it's a really good, like, scouting ground to be able to affirm, or like just 100% know that that player can probably perform at a higher level, so you can take them in. And then a counterpoint to that would be, say a player scores a hat trick against, I don't know, some absolute, like, nonsense defense, then that's not really maybe a sign that they are really good, but they're in the right place at the right time. So I think there's lots you can gain from scouting players in the World Cup, but no one would possibly take them off the back of one good tournament, I wouldn't have thought.
It's interesting, though, because this is kind of a recent phenomenon. Like, I think we all accept that it's not a good idea to buy players off tournaments anymore. But then, like, you go back to 2002, and, I mean, I know they waited a little bit afterwards, but it's the reason why Man United signed Kleberson, because he was kind of so important to that Brazilian side.
Well, in 96, I remember they signed Karol Poborski
and Jordi Cruyff. And Ferguson came out afterwards and said, oh, I'll never do that again. And, you know, it's interesting because also, like, you have a player that's potentially a bit more comfortable. Like, they're, you know, if we've just been talking about players who've won hundreds of caps at international level. And, like, I think at that level, particularly players in, for instance, Poborski's situation, there's a bit more permanence about your spot in the international team. You're not as vulnerable to kind of peaks and fluctuations in form as a club footballer might be. And so you have a little bit more, I don't know, just a bit more familiarity with your role, possibly. It's all kinds of things that distort the reality that we see during a tournament, basically.
I would say there are individual players to give a point of who stand out, oh my God, who's actually stood out at the World Cup and whose definitely profile has been risen and could then get a move. I think Amrabat's probably one of them. It's an obvious one. Gvardiol, people will go, I knew he was good. This kind of confirms it for me. I can see that he'll be able to move on. Gakpo, you could argue, we won. I think Gonçalo Ramos's performance in that hat-trick is one of those performances where you go, he's definitely got that in him. He's going to reach the level that I think he could, and that's where he'd probably go.
And now I would say he's at Angers. I hadn't heard of him before this tournament. He's just been sensational. To me, he's a classic example of somebody that everybody falls in love with, and a club that don't quite have the most refined processes spend a lot of money on, like, just instinctively, because... Yeah. You know, there's a prestige to it, JJ, as well. Like, if you're a club that signs a World Cup star, like, you know, chances were back in the day there was some cachet to that. It was like, look at what we're doing. It's a big boost. Everyone gets excited.
Well, the way before social media, it was a way to attract a new audience, because people would go and watch that team if you bring in a player from certain markets.
Yeah, there was. I remember when Coventry signed Mustafa Hadji and Yusuf Chipo, and they very briefly signed a guy called Robert Jani, who was part of Croatia's 98 run to the semifinals. Never played. He had to. Yeah. He was there for about 6 weeks and then got bounced out to Real Madrid. But it was a kind of, it was a prestige move, and it got people excited, and it sold shirts, and that time's kind of over, but it was kind of rational in an irrational way, if that makes any sense.
Mustafa Hadji came to Pataudry to play in a friendly.
He was a wonderful player. Yeah, he was great.
Did I tell my story about that?
I don't think so.
He was doing all warm-ups. They doing all, like, lovely tricks in the middle of the pitch. I have to change the words to this, because it's a swear word, which I won't say because we're on a live stream. But so
you change the swear word to not that to cabbage?
Yes, Saltino to cabbage, right? So this is
or does it need to be a cabbaging?
No, it's fine. Okay. The cabbage is good, right? So this is after France 98, and Mustafa Hadji's one of the standouts at that, I think, and he goes to Coventry somehow. They were in the Premier League at the time, and they come to play Aberdeen, used to get good teams to play them in pre-season friendlies. So in this pre-season friendly, everyone's very excited to see the star of the television everyone's been seeing, and Hadji's doing all these, like, cool tricks, putting on his head and doing all sorts of bits. And there's just two guys in front of me in the stand in Pataudry, and they're going, Mustafa! 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 For ages, like ages and ages and ages. And eventually one of them says, Mustafa! And he looks up and goes, hey! And he runs over, and he's the far side of the pitch, so he's like the opposite side diagonally from where they are, comes all the way over, gets towards them, and just as he's about to hop over the fence to get to them, they go, Mustafa, cabbage off! And then he stood like straddling a stand and he can't get off the thing. And then he has to like wander back. It was very funny.
Almost ever.
It was very funny.
Hey, the chat likes Kudus from Ajax.
Yeah,
it's a great shout. Like his stock rose. I almost don't trust it because he hasn't had a great season at Ajax.
They've played him as a nine, haven't they?
Yeah, so I'm not sure quite what to believe, but he was in. While Ghana was still in the tournament, he was absolutely unbelievable on the ball. Remind me of a kind of a more attacking Moussa Dembélé.
I saw a quote from Jordi Kroos speaking to him saying that Barca were aware of him.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, everyone's aware of everyone. I think the thing that bumps things in these sorts of tournaments is that everyone starts panicking because everyone thinks that all these clubs think no one else has seen what we've seen.
Yeah.
And they really have. And so what's going to happen is they're going to be like, oh, everyone knows about this player now, so we need to move quicker. So I definitely think there's that aspect of it.
Be horrible. If you work in a scouting department, but you aren't in charge, obviously, of like making the final decision, you love a player that you know is within the team's budget, for example, and you know would, you know, at least you have a very good idea would perform really well. But the club, for whatever reason, aren't quite moving quick enough on it. And you know that other clubs are also looking. It must be so frustrating to be in that position without having any control.
Yeah, it's competing interests. This is what makes the transfer market so difficult, because it's not just your scouting department who need to like a player, it's your recruitment department, usually the data and analysts who'll be looking at them as well, and they'll have to agree, and then you'll have the manager who may not want that player and they'll have to agree, and then there'll be the board of directors and they'll have to agree, and there'll be the owner and they have to agree. Yeah. So,
and you know me, I hate agreeing.
Yeah, exactly. If we were trying to buy a player as a group, it just wouldn't ever
be awful. That's how we ended up buying you.
I came across this situation a few weeks ago when I went to Leverkusen and spoke to Simon Rolfes about Piero Hancapi, the Ecuadorian centre back, because they'd been watching him and he played in the Copa America and he was absolutely brilliant. To the point where Leverkusen, I'd say, we need to sign him now or we'll never get the opportunity to do it ever again. To the point where they didn't actually get to meet him in person before they did the deal, apparently. So you kind of have, like, the World Cup, instead of informing decisions, like, often it seems to disrupt them for a lot of teams. Yeah. Maybe not like Manchester City and PSG and sides like that, but for teams who rely on their recruitment and rely on being a little bit smarter than everybody else, it's a huge spanner in the works. If a player is too good, it's a problem.
Yeah. Okay, very interesting conversation. Thank you all. Now, listen, let's play Points Are Bad, and we'll come back to you, JJ, to hear what you think about the final. But before we get to the final, there is, of course, the third place playoff. And that's great, because some of us here do need an extra game to try to get back into that game. And that's because, of course, today, I can tell you, John McKenzie actually won the day with a perfect score, a guess of 2-0 to France. Congratulations, John McKenzie. Followed up by Seb Stafford-Blaw with just the two. JJ, you and I have got three, and you've got, you know, joint worst for the second consecutive day. I know you're not trying or anything, but...
Well, I have been recently.
I'm wondering if you... Are you trying to lose? Because it is... No, you're not. Okay, fine. Well, there we go. Now, I'll come back to the grand scores shortly.
0 points for John McKenzie. Super impressive.
Very impressive, because he knows points are bad.
He knows
and he eschewed all of those
he
points.
He got rid of those points.
Now, listen, that means, John McKenzie, we come to you last. Not only for the third place playoff, but also for the final. Okay. Now, that does put JJ Bull in a bit of a better position, because I'm going to let him go first now.
But what are the scores? How many points do I need to make up to win?
Okay, I guess, to be fair, given that this is the last time,
we should put these.
Let's do grand totals first. You're absolutely right, because you need, you, this is true, actually. Seb needs to go first.
Yeah.
We need to reverse it, in a sense, in order that
he doesn't cheat.
That's correct.
All right.
Okay, so I'll tell you that it doesn't matter, but I have 149 points and I'm last. In joint second place is John and JJ with 137 points. So you're not just competing with Seb, JJ. You're competing with John McKenzie. And Seb Stafford-Blaw is all the way out in front with 132. Okay. He's 5 points ahead. So he's going to play it safe for these two games. We know that for sure. We know that for damn sure. But, you know, who knows what's going to happen in the runners-up game? We'll find out. Seb Stafford-Bloor, we're going to ask you to go first for both of these games, okay? And let's let you go first twice in order so that the boys here know how many points they need to be set apart from you in order to make up potentially that difference. So Croatia versus Morocco first, please.
I will say Croatia 2, Morocco 0.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's interesting. And France, Argentina, please, for the final.
I will say France 2, Argentina 1.
Okay, so those are his scores. Now, you both know that you are both 5 points behind Seb. So you need to be at least 3 aside from him,
I can
in
do
one game.
More. It's over now.
And 3 aside from him in another game. Now, I'll remind you as we go through. JJ Bull, you'll go first here. 2-0 was Seb's prediction for Croatia-Morocco. So you need to be minimum 3 away from his prediction. What do you want to go for?
I think I can get it off of the final, so it has to go my way this. Okay, I'm going to say 2-0 to Morocco.
Okay.
Right?
That's 4 swing, so that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah?
It's bold.
So I'm going to do, and then the final is either 1-0 or 0-0. What is it?
I'll tell you what, I'll go to John for Croatia-Morocco first, and then we'll come back.
Catch Seb.
What are you going to say for Croatia-Morocco? Come on, guys. Come on now. Come on. Think.
I've got my score.
Okay, what's your final score, JJ?
The final is 0-0.
You think 0-0?
Yeah.
So that puts you, all in all, 7 points away from the predictions of Seb Stafford-Bloor. If things go perfectly for you, you could still win. Now, John McKenzie, we need something similar from you, dear.
I will say
Croatia-Morocco. Now, a reminder that Seb went for 2-0 Croatia.
So 2-0 both ways, right?
He went for 2-0 Croatia, and then he went, we've got 2-0 Morocco from JJ.
I'll go 2-1.
Croatia? I wouldn't do that, because then you'll only be 1 point away from Seb. I mean,
what else am I supposed to do?
Okay, here's an option for you. Now that JJ's gone, what you could do is cling fairly neatly to Seb, left? And you could finish second if he messes up. He's gone for bold predictions to try to win, but
I'm only in it to beat JJ.
Okay, in which case, do you want to say 2-1
Croatia?
2-1 Croatia, okay. And France, Argentina?
I think Argentina 2.
You think 2 to Argentina, okay?
No. 1-0 to Argentina.
1-0 to Argentina. Oh, that's fairly, you know, theoretically, you could still joint first, I think, with that. But it does seem like you want second place. Now, it's interesting that all the different narratives playing out.
I want to win it.
You want to win it outright.
Yeah.
He just wants to beat you now. And me.
Pair of 5-0s.
Well, this is 5-0 the thing. England. I am 15, 17 points behind, so I need to be really far.
You have to go bold now.
So listen, I think Croatia-Morocco is probably going to be something like 6-2. And I think France are going to win the game, to be serious for a moment. But I think they're going to win the game 7-2.
That still doesn't catch you up.
Does it not?
I don't think so.
It's not.
It's not bold enough.
17. It's not bold enough.
No.
I meant 17-2.
Imagine if it is, though.
Imagine if
that
it is.
Incredible.
To be fair, I think if it is 17-2, I'm not going to be the big story.
Imagine if it's 17-2. They all go mad and they all get sent off.
I can't say 17-2.
If it's 17-2, goes the wrong way and you lose anyway.
I want a respectable finish here. I think France are going to win that game 3-1. That's what I think. And Croatia-Morocco, I think it's a 2-2. It's got 2-2 written all over. Who cares? There we go. Okay, fine. Well, I guess that's the end of the show, isn't it? It's certainly the end of the other show, because they're making loads of noise outside. So, you know, that's great, isn't it?
It's really good, yeah.
I think what we should do on Sunday is finish, like, really early. Ruin the show, finish at half an hour, and then go outside.
Did you know the finals are 3?
Arguably, finishing after 30 minutes is probably not ruining our show,
that's
is it?
That's true. It might be improving people it dramatically. To,
yeah. The finals are 3 p.m. on Sunday. Did you know that?
Both games are 3 p.m.
I just assumed evening. Okay.
No, it's quite nice, isn't it?
That's good.
That's a good point. A couple of things to mention. There will be a live show on Thursday, which is tomorrow. There will be a live show tomorrow. It's at 7 p.m. GMT. I won't tell you anything more about it. You won't see me, but there probably will. There probably will be a special guest joining John and JJ. Yeah, no Seb's applause. But we'll be back on Sunday, streaming immediately after the final, so probably around 5 o'clock. But whenever the game finishes, we'll be here, and that's when we'll say goodbye to you for the live streams for the time being.
Oh,
excuse me, that's a bit gassy.
Don't be that in the podcast.
Bit gassy there. No, away from the microphone. You know, people understand this is a real humans with real anatomies.
I've been trying to get too many, as in it's you and me. It's our destiny.
And it's Chew-a-many.
No. Like, as in the line where it goes, it's Chew-a-many. I know it's my destiny.
Oh, I see. In there.
But I never got a chance to do it. And I didn't just put it in. So I just wanted to let you know that I had.
Give you an opportunity to do a quick Rooney.
Not on command.
Not on command. Soon. Okay. In which case, I will say.
Can we have the song? Everyone wants the song.
Oh, yeah. The song. Oh, lots of requests for the techno version. Is that possible at last minute notice? No. In which case, let's listen to Van Summer's song, and then we'll have the techno one for the final, Jamie. Yeah, thanks. Let's listen as we say goodbye. Thank you to John McKenzie. Thank you to JJ Bull the Buller. Thank you to Seb Sapper-Law. Thanks to the production
suite. Thank you, Joe Devine.
Thank you to editor Nathan. As I said, there's a show tomorrow, but I'll be back on Sunday, and we will play out now to Van Summer's, who we thank greatly for Points of Sad.